and then we'll begin some discussion of the theory of measurement. I guess you'll have to wait till this weekend to get those notes. I didn't get it done last night. Okay, so the other example I wanted to give for a simple model of decoherence is called phase damping. Okay, so we can have, for example, remember our operational paradigm. This is the go button, and we have a knob, and then something invisible comes out. And then we have a light here that goes off. So this means event detected. Event detected, and then this has a knob which selects the measurement. And then it also has a pointer, which is our readout. We're going to need this for measurement anyway, so I'll mention it. Okay, so let me just, so a run of the experiment, a run is pressing go, pressing the go button once. And getting a readout, getting a single outcome readout. Readout, which is exactly an eigenvalue of the observable. Okay, so this is sometimes called a single shot experiment. And then whenever we have an expectation value like this of some quantity A, where A is some observable, then this is equal to an ensemble average over single runs. Over single shot repetitions. Of the same experiment, of the same procedure. Okay, so just to establish some terminology here. So when I say a single run, I just mean you press the button once and you get a readout. So you don't get the expectation value out. That's from post-processing a large collection of experiments. All right, so now we have our transformation box. Okay, so we have the preparation or some other box spits out a system. And then the transformation box gives us no information. What distinguishes a transformation box from a measurement box is the lack of a light and a pointer. So the transformation box just has a dial which picks which transformation you're applying, which is we know now via the Steinspring dilation theorem. There's going to be a unitary in some Hilbert space, pretty much in full generality. So that's, you can always model this via some unitary in some Hilbert space that's possibly larger than the Hilbert space of the system. Let me call A the system and E the environment. This, of course, you might not need the extra Hilbert space, but on the other hand, if you include it, you can describe with complete generality what occurs inside this box. Okay, so suppose there is some noise in our transformation, is some classical noise. In the transformation box, due to a fluctuating classical field. Okay, so ideally, the ideal transformation might be just a rotation. So for example, the ideal transformation might be something like we have some Hamiltonian which couples let me write it as gamma B naught dot SZ, which leads to a rotation of a spin half particle, or any spin for that matter, but let's just make it concrete. Okay, so what is the unitary generated by a Hamiltonian? So here we have some classical magnetic field. This is a scalar. So here the point is that B naught is some real number, which corresponds to the strength of the magnetic field. Gamma is a coupling constant between the magnetic field and the dipole moment of the electron. So now this is the only operator valued quantity here is the Z component, because this is the magnetic field along the Z axis. Just to make an example, this is a comma. All right, so then this induces a rotation e to the minus I ht over h bar, which is equal to e to the minus I, let's set h bar equal to 1, as z, actually let me do this, theta as z, where theta is equal to omega times the time divided by h bar. Okay, so now we realize that e to the minus I theta sz, we can just call this rz theta. Okay, rz theta means it's an element of, it's isomorphic to an element of O3, which means it's a rotation in three-dimensional space. In addition to being a unitary operator in some dimension, like a two-dimensional Hilbert space. Yeah?
Does transformation occur before it goes
to that measurement box after? No, I'm giving you an example of what's happening inside the box. So when you set this dial, you're choosing this coupling, and you're choosing the time, which ends up giving you one effective parameter, theta. So essentially, this dial is picking out theta. These are different values of theta. And also the axis. So theta, and it's also picking out the axis of rotation, n hat. Okay, so I can write SZ. I won't write that. It's clear. Yes?
You mentioned the classical noise.
That's coming up. Yeah. So now, if I have perfect control of my magnetic field or my timing, right, so my timing might be off. I might have imperfection in measuring time. I might also have some, I will definitely have some error in measuring, in controlling the time. And I will also have some error in controlling the magnetic field. So for example, there might be fluctuations in my circuitry. And I'll probably also have difficulty controlling the magnetic field to be precisely along some axis. There'll be fluctuations in the x and y components, which are supposed to be zero, but they'll fluctuate. Okay, so those are all just errors that occur all the time. They're ubiquitous. So we want some way to accommodate that. And it'll come back to me. Okay. So now suppose, and you don't really have to suppose this. It'd be weird to suppose otherwise. Suppose maybe I should call this tau, because tau is more of a parameter associated with the time it takes the particle to transverse the box. But let me just do it this way. Or B naught is fluctuating. Oh, this is what I wanted to say. So what that means is that each time I press the go button, so when I drew this, I should have drawn this in this picture. Okay? So each time I press the go button, the invisible particle goes through the box, and I describe what happens with some unitary. So I'm going to imagine for simplicity that there's no environment now. There's no quantum degree of freedom that's impacting this evolution. Okay, I just have this ideal coupling, and my only problem in life is that my field is fluctuating. So each time I put the particle through the box, there will be some fixed field. So each particle sees a definite unitary. And then I get some eigenvalue outcome. But when I compare to experiment, I'm comparing to an ensemble average. So I repeat this experiment many times. And now each time it goes through the box, it sees a slightly different magnetic field because that field is fluctuating. So that means that so each particle sees a fixed U theta, but theta is varying from run to run. Okay, this leads to a very common form of noise called T2 noise. This leads to a process known as T2, or it's called phase damping, and we'll see why in a minute, or dephasing. When I say or, I mean these are just different communities have different terminology, so I should make equal signs. Equal to dephasing, which is sometimes called decoherence, which is a kind of decoherence. Okay, so now how do I model this? What I model this as is my transformation then, I'm going to represent it. This is this mixture of unitaries we saw earlier. So the input state rho is going to be I'll make it an integral over d theta, some probability distribution over theta, which is determined by the properties of the fluctuating classical field, and then some u theta rho u theta dagger. So here p theta is a probability distribution modeling my fluctuations. Okay, so now we can always describe the transformation like this. This is perfectly valid, but for simplicity of representation, we'd like to find a set of Krauss operators to model this. Okay, so before we do that, let's see what the effective action is. So let's calculate this. Okay, so to make the calculation simple, let's assume p theta is a Gaussian, which is of course a very common model, where it goes as e to the minus theta squared over 4 sigma. Sigma is the variance. Sorry, I should have called it sigma squared. In fact, I will call it sigma squared. So now sigma is equal to the standard deviation of the fluctuations. Okay, so sigma is not an operator, it's just a real number. And then I need a normalization factor. And then what we get is that rho prime, which is equal to lambda acting on rho, which is the output state from the transformation box, is going to be rho 0, 0, e to the minus sigma squared, rho 0, 1, rho 1, 0, e to the minus sigma squared, rho 1, 1. Okay, where here I'm implicitly defining rho has a matrix representation, rho 0, 0, rho 0, 1, rho 1, 0, rho 1, 1. So this is actually the representation of rho prime in some basis. So what happens? So as the fluctuations get bigger, sigma gets bigger, we find that we attenuate the off-diagonal elements in the z basis, which what that means is we are removing the coherence. Okay, so if the input state was the plus x eigenstate, plus 1x, okay, where this is defined as Sx acting on plus 1x is equal to h bar over 2 plus 1x. Okay, so this state is equal to 0 plus 1 over square root of 2. And then for this state, rho 0, 1 is equal to, 1. Or 1 over square root of, what is it? A half? I think that's right. So the half is the maximum coherence. This is a pure state. So this has the maximum coherence between 0 and 1. And now when I send it through this channel, this transformation, that the magnitude of that term gets decreased. And we call that decoherence. You're losing your coherence between the two states. You're going from a coherent superposition of 0 and 1, which shows interference, to a mixture of 0 and 1, which does not show interference. And we have a continuous parameter for the strength of that process. And that continuous parameter, which is this guy, gets bigger when the fluctuations get bigger. So the bigger your fluctuations, the worse your control, the more you lose decoherence. Okay, this is why it's hard to build a quantum computer, because the coherence is what we need to make it work. I thought I saw a hand up at some point there.
So two questions. Basically, you got this by doing that integral.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Second thing, if you have a description of transformation which is given by a continuous, like an integral like that, can you always find a number of discrete cross-operators?
Yeah, that's what we're doing next. Okay, so now next is let's find some cross-operators. Because in a sense, and this was a question that was raised some time ago, a couple days ago, you could think of this as a continuously infinite set of cross-operators, where each cross-operator is the square root of p times u. But now that's not very economical to represent the map that way. If I want to program it on MATLAB or something, what I'm going to do is let's find the Krauss operators for this channel. Let's find a set, because the Krauss operators are non-unique. Okay, so I'm just going to give you a set of Krauss operators and show you that they work. So we take a0 to be 1, 0, 0, 1 minus lambda, and a1 to be 0, 0, 0 square root of lambda. And then we can observe that rho, which is equal to rho prime is equal to a0 rho a0 dagger plus a1 rho a1 dagger, which is, of course, some abstract map lambda acting on the input state. And we can calculate what we get. And using the same notation as here, using this convention for characterizing rho, which is pretty standard, what we get is rho 0, 0, 1 minus lambda, rho 0, 1, 1 minus lambda, rho 1, 0, and then rho 1, 1. Okay, so now we can connect 1 minus lambda is defined as e to the minus sigma squared. What this does is this connects. So this is an arbitrary dephasing channel on a single qubit. parameterized by some parameter lambda between 0 and 1. And if we want to say, well, I had this particular model with the Gaussian, which is a specific example, then the connection is we define lambda. Well, you would take the square and do the manipulations to connect it to sigma. So lambda is a function of sigma, which is the strength of the fluctuation. But this gives a more very general model. So this is called the phase damping model. And so if we have time to connect this to the Lindblad picture, then we'll see how this parameter T2 arises in a continuous limit. But that'll be depending on level of interest. Question in the back.
So what is the physical meaning of lambda?
The physical meaning? Well, it depends on what's happening inside the box. So there's lots of things that can happen inside the box that will be modeled by this channel. So it's a one-to-many relation between this model and physical situations. If the physical situation is the one I described here, then the physical meaning of lambda is that it's this function of sigma squared. Actually, that's a good point. So let's see if that even makes sense here. So here, as sigma goes to 0, we get 1. And as sigma goes to infinity, we get 0. So OK, at least we're consistent. So we have 1 minus lambda is equal to e to the minus sigma squared all squared, which is what, 2 sigma squared? And then lambda is going to be equal to 1 minus e to the minus 2 sigma squared. So now if this goes between 0 and 1, then this goes between 0 and 1. OK, so that's some physics. Now we're going to do some math. Oh, one more piece of physics. So if you remember the amplitude damping channel, what do I want to say about that? If you remember the amplitude damping channel, you'll recall that what it did was, I'll just write it down here. Remember, amplitude damping was a very general model which included spontaneous emission. That was kind of the paradigm we looked at for what produced. So amplitude damping, we got that rho prime was equal to, represented as rho 0, 0 plus gamma rho 1, 1. 1 minus gamma rho 1, 0, 1 minus gamma rho 0, 1. And then what was this? This was 1 minus gamma rho 1, 1. All right, so this is our matrix. So a few observations. If you have spontaneous emission or any other method of amplitude damping, there's a couple of key points you want to see. First of all, we think of amplitude damping as switching the population. So you go from having some population in an excited state to less population in the excited state and more population in the ground state, right? That's the key central feature. And a byproduct of that process is that it attenuates the off-diagonals. So you get dephasing as a consequence of amplitude damping at some kind of intermediate stage. Because if I let this amplitude damping, if I make a composite evolution where I do one iteration of amplitude damping and then another iteration and then another iteration by putting these boxes together sequentially, I'm going to continuously drive the system towards the ground state. So asymptotically, for any value of gamma, if I repeat this process, if I chain together these boxes, which is associated with just waiting in time, basically, so the box is kind of a heavy-handed description of just having a system and just waiting. Because everything's coupled to the vacuum, right? You can't get rid of that. Then what's going to happen? You're going to take an arbitrary input state, including the maximally mixed state, and you're going to drive it to the ground state. So amplitude damping, first of all, causes dephasing intermediately. But more importantly, asymptotically, it creates a pure state. So what that means, we call it decoherence, but it's actually kind of increasing your coherence, right? It's giving you a pure state at the end. You start from a mixed state, you get a purer state out. The problem is that pure state is going to have nothing to do with the previous state. You're going to have destroyed whatever properties existed of the previous state and create a new pure state to replace it. So this is a standard method of state preparation. So if I want to do some experiments on a system, whether it's an atom trapped in a cavity or a nuclear spin in a, you know, in the solid state or in the liquid state, which is coupled to a thermal reservoir, then I want to start out in the ground state because that's a pure state. And then I can manipulate it and create coherence by applying pulses to it, laser pulses or electromagnetic or RF frequency pulses in the case of NMR. And then I'm going to drive it to do all kinds of interesting things. But what I want to start out is I want a pure state that I know what that pure state is. So the ground state is great for that. So this is a state preparation procedure, which is associated with just waiting for the system to relax to its equilibrium. If that equilibrium is a ground state, if the temperature is cold enough, then that the equilibrium state will be close to the ground state. And then I'll get a pure state out of this process. So just be careful the word decoherence, even though it suggests loss of coherence, can actually be associated with processes that create coherence. That's not the case for phase damping, where it only destroys coherence. It never creates coherence. All right, good. So, okay. Now, let's transition from physics to math. Oh, sorry, there was a question. Wait, I can't hear you while the board is going. Just wait a second.
When you say growth represented by that, you mean just because it's just a basis?
Yeah, it's a matrix. I mean, there's a difference between an operator, a linear operator. I mean, think about, you know, second grade linear algebra. Okay, so you have an abstract operator, and then we're going to express it as a matrix. So what we do to do that, we choose a basis. Yeah, so I mean, I'm using heavy-handed language because I'm in a math department, so you get indoctrinated to distinguish things that as physicists we treat as equivalent. So yeah, it's just being careful about what things are. So yeah, that's why I don't put an equal sign, because this is a representation. It's a kind of a baby example of representation theory. It's just the simplest case of I'm choosing a basis and writing it as a matrix. Yeah. Oh no. Thank you. Okay, you guys are sharp. All right. Now, okay, some math. So before I just start throwing math at you, although some of you will probably love it, let me at least motivate it first. The point is that our quantum channel or map, or sometimes called our super operator, there's a lot of terminology for this, lambda, which takes as input some density operator and produces as output some other density operator. Okay, here's a piece of math. So we have to distinguish between, let me define D of H. So we can talk about, so the point is rho is an element of D of H. Rho and rho prime are both elements of D of H, which is the set of density operators. Should have introduced that a long time ago. Set of density operators, which is a subset of the linear operators on H. Okay, so there's some, you want to distinguish between taking an element of the set to an element of the set and taking the whole set to the whole set. So in one of these cases, and I can never remember which, you're supposed to put an arrow like that. Does anyone know which it is? I got it right? Okay, good. So the point is, and I wanted to, this is just an aside here. The point is this is a linear map by assumption. It's a linear map of a set to a set. Okay, and that set is our physically relevant set of density operators. And now we have this Krauss representation theorem, and we have all of this unfamiliar mathematical structure associated with that. But the point is, it's just a linear map. So we can just use linear algebra, and we can express lambda as a matrix acting on a vector. And that vector is the density operator. Okay, so here's going to be the point of subtlety that might lead to confusion. Okay, so the super operator is just a linear operator on a vector space. Okay, that vector space consists of the density operators. This vector space, this is a vector space of linear operators, a vector space of linear operators. So we have the super operator is a linear map acting on a vector space which itself consists of linear operators, right? So rho is a linear operator on H. Okay, now here's why I'm emphasizing this. It turns out that it's actually a Hilbert space because we can define an inner product on the set of linear operators, which is an inner product on another vector, which defines a Hilbert space because it's complete in the norm. Okay, so what that means is that the set of density operators The set of density operators are elements of a Hilbert space. So the density operators are linear operators on a Hilbert space. Okay, this means that rho is a linear operator on H. But it's also a vector in a Hilbert space. So what this means is that rho is an element of some new Hilbert space, which I'm going to call HL. So it's both a vector on a Hilbert space and an element of a Hilbert space. Yes?
In general, the space of linear operators is not a Hilbert space, right? But you're saying that the set...
In finite dimensions, it is. In finite dimensions, it always is.
In finite dimensions, every vector space is a Hilbert
space. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. But for infinite dimensions, there's going to be subtleties about bounded operators and so on, which we're going to get to. Okay.
And so, but you're saying that so density operators they get like a sub Hilbert property of this space.
Okay, you're getting ahead. I'm just explaining to the rest of the group here that we can think of this as a Hilbert space if we introduce an inner product. All right. Now you're talking about what's the relationship of the set of density operators to that set of linear operators that forms the Hilbert space. So that's you're getting ahead of things. Just bear with me, and I think it'll become clear. Okay, the point is, there we go. The point is we can define an inner product between two operators, rho and rho prime. Now these are density operators, which is defined as the trace of row adjoint row prime. So more generally, if we have A and B, we define the inner product to be the trace of A dagger B. Yes?
On the exercise sheet, we had a trace distance defined, and that would also work as a scalar product, right? Because it's the difference of the two density operators.
Well, it's a norm.
You square that and take the square root, and it's on the definite, it's a metric, it's a norm.
Yeah, so it's a norm. So inner product induces a norm, but given the norm, it's not obvious what the inner product would be. So this introduces a norm as well, but I don't know what inner product induced the trace distance. I'd have to think about that. So the point is, what's the benefit of this is that, so then given any linear operator, A, which is a linear operator on some base Hilbert space, to make things clear, let's fix H to be equal to some d-dimensional complex vector space. Okay, so now we have vectors psi, which are elements of CD, and then the projector, which is a pure preparation, so for a pure density operator, rho would be equal to psi psi. So it's an element of the linear operators on CD. But now what I'm saying is that psi psi is also a vector in a Hilbert space, which is called the Liouville space, which is exactly equal to CD squared. So we've squared the dimension of the Hilbert space, and we now have a Hilbert space of density operators. Okay, so with this inner product. And so this is true for any row. Now for any row, well, it's true for any linear operator, but it's most interesting when it's a density operator. Or any element of LCD for that matter. We have that rho is an element of CD squared. Okay, so what does this mean? This means, for example, all of the properties that are familiar to us from doing quantum mechanics, we can now do for open quantum systems, for realistic systems. So just like any state psi can be decomposed with respect to a basis, where phi L is an orthonormal basis for CD. Similarly, any A, which is a linear operator on CD, so an observable or a state, we can write it as A equals sum over K equals 1 to D squared. Let me call it alpha K BK. So I should mention here, of course, you know this, but the point is, how do you find these coefficients CL? So CL is actually equal to the inner product of phi L with psi, which is a complex number. And we interpret this as a matrix representation as some coefficients. You know, I already have a subscript here, unfortunately. Phi L1, phi L2, dot, dot, dot. And then we have a column vector for psi, which is going to be psi 1, psi 2. And we evaluate this inner product via the matrix representation. Similarly, we can do the same here. So I should write this as a ket now, because we can use Dirac notation. So the operator A can be thought of as a vector, which is an element of CD squared, and the coefficients alpha k are given by BKA. I can choose to put the hats on here or not, just a matter of whatever you find reminds you of what you're doing best. And then I evaluate this object via this mathematical rule. Oh, whoops. Which is a complex number. And I'll mention here that this set of objects BK is an orthonormal basis for CD squared, which is essentially isomorphic to the linear operators on CD. This sum should be D squared, thank you. So we go from having D coefficients in the base Hilbert space to D squared coefficients in the Liouville space. Okay, and the orthonormality condition is obvious. It means the trace of BK dagger BL is equal to delta KL. So the upshot of this is that lambda acting on rho, which is expressed sometimes somewhat clumsily as a Krauss representation, we can think of this instead as a matrix relationship. Lambda acting on rho is equal to rho prime, where this is a column vector whose coefficients are determined by the trace of BK dagger rho. And similarly, this is a column vector whose coefficients are trace of BK dagger rho prime. And here the matrix lambda, which is called the Liouville matrix, the matrix elements lambda alpha beta is equal to the trace of B alpha lambda B beta. So these are the ways you'd usually, which you can think of this, this is equivalent to saying B alpha lambda B beta in Dirac notation. All right, so this is Dirac notation for this quantity. So this gives a, in many practical calculations, this is a much more natural picture for talking about the kinds of linear transformations that can occur for a general quantum system. Okay, so now let me make this a little bit more formal. We have so a Hilbert-Schmidt operator A is a bounded linear operator such that there exists an orthonormal basis on our base Hilbert space such that the sum over the elements of the basis of the norm squared of A acting on each basis element, which we can write out in this way. Is bounded, is finite. Okay, this guarantees that any Hilbert-Schmidt operator has a finite Hilbert-Schmidt norm. Which we call A2, and it's equal to the trace of A dagger A all square rooted. And here's the key point, the set of Hilbert-Schmidt operators forms a Hilbert space with respect to what's called the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product, which is the one I introduced. So the inner product is A, B is equal to trace of A dagger B. Okay, so many operators of interest in quantum mechanics, all density operators and all bounded observables are Hilbert-Schmidt operators, and so we can talk about them as elements of a Hilbert space, which means we recover this picture, and in particular, we recover Dirac notation. So now you can just abstract the idea that just like in ideal quantum mechanics, a transformation is a unitary, which is a matrix that acts on a vector, which is the state, and that's a pure state. Now we have that exact same structure at a higher conceptual level. The most general transformation, assuming uncorrelated initial states, is a completely positive map. That's a linear map. Therefore, it can be expressed as a matrix acting on a vector, which is the vector of coefficients of the density operator, which can be a mixed state. And we can represent that linear algebra via Dirac notation because we have a Hilbert space, and so we have Rietz's theorem and all those nice properties that come with it. So, strictly speaking, this B alpha here, this is a bra, which is an element of the dual space. It's a linear functional acting on the ket, which in this case, this is the ket. It's lambda acting on B, which is the output of this, which is some other matrix, which is the right-hand side of this inner product. It's that piece there. Okay, so basically, so even though we're talking about a different conceptual level of realistic description of quantum systems, we actually have the same structure, we just lose unitarity. So this transformation isn't necessarily a unitary anymore. But this state can be a pure state in the bigger Hilbert space. Actually, I haven't thought about that too much, what that means. But yeah, probably not much. Okay, any questions about this mathematical, there's more detail. I define bounded linear operators in the notes. These are the notes you already have, if you've taken a look at them. And there's more discussion of norms and such, which if you have any questions about that, please just ask. Yeah?
You define the Hilbert-Schmidt operator with, like, is there any, like, is the statement say that there exists some orthonormal basis such that norm of A?
Let me get the precise wording. Yeah, it's only that there exists. It's not for any.
No, it's not for any.
Yeah.
Sometimes it can matter.
Yeah, I mean, that's what that implies. But I'm not, I haven't thought about that nuance. Yes?
The spin-off product structure is inherited from the lower, from the vector space, right?
It's not guaranteed somehow. Like, I mean, if you're talking about, if you're dealing with infinite dimensions as one of the students, yeah, in the finite case, it's definitely, yeah, it all follows, it's implied, basically. In the infinite dimensional case, you have to be subtle about the class of operators, which have properties so that the inner product is bounded and well-defined. And that's, you know, I mean, as a physicist, you say, look, if the linear operator doesn't satisfy that, it's not physically interesting, right? So you just kind of assume by fiat that for physically relevant quantities, we're going to have finite properties, and this will all apply. Okay, so we've done something very practically physics-y. We've done something very mathematical. And now we're going to do something very conceptual, which is my favorite of the three. And we'll talk about measurement. Okay, so now this piece for the last 15 minutes, I haven't provided notes to you yet. You'll get the notes this weekend. So, here we go. All right, let's talk a little bit about giving you some kind of empirical meaning to quantities. Okay, so let's just start with a pop quiz. Okay, so what's the difference? What's the difference between measuring? Okay, so let's start. We're assuming we have a composite system. What's the difference between measuring A tensor B? To make this easy, I'll make it an expectation value. And measuring, so this is, we can just call this AB. So A is going to be a linear operator on HA, and B is going to be a linear operator on HB. Obviously, since we're measuring them, we assume they're not just linear operators, but they're self-adjoint. So this is the same thing. This is where we include or don't include the tensor product. And measuring A plus B, which is what we mean by that, is A tensor identity plus identity tensor B. Okay, so what, for example, can, okay, this is a very broad, open question. Let me give you more precisely. What could you find out by measuring this instead of this about the input state?
Correlations.
Thank you. Correlations, exactly. So this detects correlations. And this doesn't. Okay, so let's look in this kind of, you know, in quantum information, the beauty of it is it establishes a common language for all of these different approaches to quantum physics, whether it's condensed matter, NMR, atomic optics, superconducting qubits, all that stuff. We have a common language so that we can, it's, you know, obviously even the terminology and the notation, if those are different between communities, it can create a major barrier to understanding what each other are doing. So let me, one of the tools in that framework, and I'm not like pushing quantum information on you, but just there is a common language here which I think is be useful for the whole community discussing quantum physics to use, and in particular a diagram, the diagrammatic picture of quantum circuits, which I've used already. So you think of each system as being a line, and you typically think of this direction as time. And you think of this as space. Okay, so now I have some system. I like to put my ancilla system B on top. Here it's not an ancilla, it's just a different system. So my row for system B and my row for system A here. But in practice, the input can be correlated. So instead, I just say, look, there's some joint state of row AB. And then a measurement like this, which gives some output k, this corresponds to a measurement of this type, A tensor B. Sorry, actually, what am I doing? So two separate measurements on each system. Okay, so each one produces some output. Let's call this KA, and this is KB. So we have independent choices of what the measurement is. So each of these guys, if I think of it in my box picture, each has its own dial. And I can turn this dial, and I can turn this dial independently. Later on, this will be really important when we talk about Bell's theorem, where we're going to make these outside each other's light cones. But for now, we just imagine the systems are next to each other, and we assume that we have agents who have free will. May not be true, but we assume it. And they can independently set the dials. Okay? We need a notion of independence to do physics. Whether you couch that notion in free will or some other concept is up to you. All right, so we have independent dials here. And then this corresponds to a measurement of this form. So in any given run, I press the button, I get outcomes. I get one outcome KA and I get one outcome KB. And then I can repeat many times and I can look for correlations between the outcomes. And if the input state is correlated, then I will find correlations in the sequence of outcomes. All right, if I just do the experiment once, there's no way I'm going to know they're correlated or not. Correlation means covariation. So that means I need a variable that's varying. I need a pair of variables which are both varying and whose variation is correlated. So here the variation is overruns. Each time I do the run, I get a different outcome KA and a different outcome KB, and I look for covariation between them. And that's what this mathematical object represents, is the measurement of experimental procedure of this form. Yes?
This correlation of the input state that can correspond either to an entangled input state, but also to a weirdly prepared statistical.
Exactly. That's a very important point. Yeah. So I will see correlations in this. Whether rho AB, so I will see correlations in two cases. One is that rho AB is a classical mixture of rho AL tensor rho BL. So this has no entanglement, which we haven't done theory of entanglement yet, so I'm sorry this is a forward reference. But you can think of it this way. This is just a classical correlation. When Alice prepares the first system, she prepares it up. And she says, hey, Bob, prepare your system up on the first system. So he does that. When they do it the second time, they both decide to put it down and so on. That's just the classical correlation between two variables. There's nothing quantum mechanical there. We're just describing it with quantum operators because that's the most general description for anything. Or you can have it when rho AB is entangled. So in both cases, we'll see some correlation. Whereas if we measure something like this, OK, the circuit picture for this is that I do one of two different experiments. So this means that half the time when I press go, I do this measurement. This is system B. I got these backwards, didn't I? This is KB, and this is KA. Not that it really matters, just arbitrary. I get outcome KB, different KB each run. And this system goes into the garbage can. OK, I don't even care what happens to it. All right, and then the other half of the time, I do this experiment where this one goes into the garbage can, and I measure this, and I get some outcome KA. And then I repeat that many, many times. And then by linearity, this is equal to the expectation of A tensor identity plus the expectation of identity tensor B, which is just the expectation of A plus the expectation of B, which, as you can see, it's just, OK, well, it doesn't really matter if system A is even in the picture. All I know is I have some reduced state for B, and I'm measuring that. And then later on, I decide to do this experiment, and I measure this. And then just for fun, I decide to add up the expectation values, because that's what I feel like doing. Okay, so that's what this corresponds to. All right, so these are some of the primitives we need. And now I want to derive the update rule for you. Okay? That's why I'm going through this. I hope you guys are starting to trust me more now. But so the update rule is a classical process, okay? So there's nothing really that interesting about it. There's one of my favorite quotes is from Hideo Mabuchi, who's a physicist. Where is he at? Stanford or Caltech or something? I don't know where he is now. He did his PhD with Jeff Kimball. Anyways, he has this quip that the measurement problem is a set of people, which I absolutely love because it's so true. All right, so how do we describe state update? Okay, well, in general, we can't, okay? You know, it's like you say, hey, I have this box, and I prepared something in this box. How did I do it? Well, I have no idea. The box is closed, okay? If you don't tell me how you did it, I have no idea how to describe what's inside the box, okay? So if you're just saying, oh, I did a measurement of A, what's the state after measurement? Well, I have no idea. It depends how you did the measurement, all right? So the state update rule applies if you follow a very special procedure for the measurement. That's when it applies, and when you apply that special procedure, we can then just derive it from our postulates, okay? So suppose we know that the measurement procedure is what I'll call maximally distinguishing. And repeatable. Okay, so now if I promise those properties, I can tell you what the state after the measurement is. So what do I mean? So by maximally distinguishing, all right, and I forgot, okay, I'm kind of doing this on the fly, so I'm forgetting things as I go. Let me just say, and it's ideal. Okay, so we're using the ideal axioms, and later on we'll generalize this. But for now, let's just assume this just to see the key conceptual ideas. Okay, so if it's maximally distinguishing, what all I mean here is that the measurement, the operator A, its spectral decomposition, which is always of this form, satisfies the fact that we have rank one projectors. PL is equal to some phi L for every L. Okay, so it can maximally distinguish the components of any input state in the Hilbert space it's acting on. So if this is, let's just do this in finite dimensions for conceptual clarity, then L is going to go from 1 to D. Oh, this is a mistake. This is linear operators on CD. But now we know we can just think of this as the Liouville space CD squared. Okay, it's an element of CD squared. Okay, so that's maximally distinguishing. Ideal means it's a self-adjoint operator. It's not a POVM. Now, what's repeatable? We already discussed repeatable. It means if I get some outcome and I repeat the same procedure again on the same system, the system that came out of that, I get the same outcome. All right, if I do a lousy job with my measurement device, that's not always going to be true. Okay, so repeatable means that the same measurement procedure applied sequentially produces the same result. By the same result, I mean the same outcome. And each outcome is labeled by an eigenvalue, so I get the same eigenvalue. Okay, I showed you a picture of this before. Let me just show it again. What it means is I have my system. It goes into my box. My box has my dial and my pointer and my light. And then this is a dashed line because it's invisible. And then I have the same box made by the same manufacturer, and I have the same dial setting. I demand that I get the same pointer result. Okay, so if the box satisfies that property, which basically means, means what it means. It means it's a good measurement of a certain type. And I know that it's maximally distinguishing set of input states, which I can, of course, test by just putting in all d different input states, phi, and testing that I get each of the outcomes, al, for each of those states, right? I can test the device. So I can check both of these properties experimentally. And this thing, I think that follows as well. Let me think about that a little bit. Any questions about the setup? Yes. Yeah. Well, he's just saying that isn't it kind of obvious at this point that by imposing repeatability, the state has to be the input state. It's not, what you said is not true without caveats. So I'm going to give you an example of repeatability for a non-maximally distinguishing measurement where the state is not, the output state is not the input state. Okay, you'll probably see this right away, but if I have a rank 2 subspace, the state can move around in that rank 2 subspace. So the state update rule as stated normally is not true. I can have some unitary rotation within the subspace of my degenerate eigenvalue. So that's getting ahead of everyone. Sorry, that's getting ahead of myself. So now let's think about how we do this now. So now let's think about the von Neumann indirect measurement. Okay, so now I think about what's happening inside the box. Is that I have my ancilla system in some state phi, and I'm coupling my input state of my system, which I'll just use a pure state for simplicity here. And then the goal of this unitary is, I'm measuring A, what do I have over there as an index for A, L? So I'm going to expand psi out, so my initial state is psi tensor phi, and then that's going to evolve under U to sum over L CL L tensor L, where here psi, I'm going to expand psi out in terms of the observable I'm measuring. And I get these coefficients CL. This is just what psi looks like over the eigenstates of the measurement of the measurement operator. All right, so the point is in order to create a measurement device which has these properties, I can do it via von Neumann's indirect measurement. U is constrained to be designed such that this is true, which under constrains U, as we talked about previously. And now I'm going to measure the ancilla. I'm going to get some outcome KB, where here KB is one of the L's. Okay, so KB is some number that goes from 1 to D. And then I'm also going to delay my measurement of system A. And I'm going to get some outcome KA, which is an element from 1 to D. Now the point is KA and KB are going to be correlated because the state is correlated. It's not only correlated, it's entangled. Okay, so this is represented by, right. So earlier I think one of the students asked, how do you know that the state at this stage right here, how do you know that that state, if I get outcome k equals 3, suppose then k equals 3, how do I know that the state here, the appropriate state to describe this piece right here, is the state 3? Or I guess I should call it A3. Although, I guess I called, yeah, I mean, I hope this doesn't bother you guys, but, phi 3, that's what it was. A3 would have been a better choice of notation, but we'll stick with phi 3. Okay, this phi has nothing to do with this phi. Which you can tell from the font I'm using, I'm sure. Okay, so the point is this, is that, look, we know that we can just calculate the effect of, this is going to be some observable B, which is onto the eigenspace L states here, so it's going to be BL, LL, L goes from 1 to D squared, and then if I do this measurement, then I have to get outcome phi 3 because I got K 3 here. Is that crystal clear? Or do you guys want me to be? I hope it's clear. Come on, I feel like I could do a better job of explaining it, but I'm not really seeing how. Does anyone doubt that if I get outcome 3 here, I can get anything other than outcome 3 here if that's the input state? When I say input state, this is the state at this stage here. So input to the measurement, not input to the unitary. The unitary creates this correlation. What can I do? I guess I can just write out A tensor B. Let me do it this way. Let me take the state 3 tensor 3 and measure its expectation value. Well, this is A and this is B. And when I say 3, I mean phi 3. Well, because look, I called it L here. So L is going from 1 to D squared. So I'm allowed to call it 3. But it's what corresponds to phi 3 in the way I defined A over there. Is that obvious? Okay, I'm not confusing you guys too much. Look, so let me just measure this projector. This is the projector associated with getting outcome 3 here and outcome 3 here. And then what I do is I plug in this state. And then what's going to happen is this is A. I'm not even going to write this out for you guys. Okay, I'm just going to tell you. Look, I'm writing this as a ket here. This L is going to hit this 3, and it's going to create a Kronecker delta function, which is going to force L to be 3 also for A. Okay? QED. So there we go. So now we know we have to get 3, but the only way we can always get 3, given that we can delay the measurement of A, is if the state at this point in time is 3. I should have chose 42, I guess. And then we're done, right? So now we know that by virtue of von Neumann's indirect measurement as a model realizing a measurement with this capability, this output state is uniquely determined. This is not my argument. This is von Neumann's argument from 1931. Von Neumann's argument in 1931 used conservation, I mentioned this previously, used conservation of energy and momentum to deduce this. But he was dealing with infinite dimension Hilbert space and assuming infinitely precise measurements, and it's a mess. So this is just a cleaner version in finite dimensions. Well, I guess you can debate whether it's cleaner. Illustrating the idea that the update rule is determined by those properties of measurement. All right, that's probably a good point to stop. We have more to say about this. We'll look at the update rule for realistic scenarios with POVMs. When we have degenerate eigenvalues, what happens? And discuss that in some detail on Monday. You'll have the notes before you, so it'll be easier to follow. But before we wrap up, are there any questions about this? Yeah, these are orthonormal projectors. Yeah, this is a spectral decomposition. Anything else?
If there is a true observer, and act right, who are watching that measurement and they are, one observer is moving relative to the other, then like the, what is it called? Like something occurred at the same time is not, they do not agree with which event occurred at the same time. So in that case, observer A and observer B may consider, describe differently the state of the, what was inside side after the
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, well, you don't even need relativity. I mean, just consider the fact that, you know, this is Bob and this is Alice. Bob does a measurement and doesn't tell Alice what he got. Then Alice's description here is not going to be 3. It's going to be the mixed state where she just throws this in the garbage can because she has no information about it. So she takes the partial trace. And because this is a maximally entangled state, she's going to assign the identity state, because she knows this happened. So she says, I have no idea what outcome I'm going to get. But if Bob measures his outcome, then I'll find out. That is not quantum mechanics. That's classical physics. I mean, if we have 2 cards, a 3 of spades and a 4 of clubs, and we shuffle them, and I give you a card, and I take a card, and we don't look at them, my description of what card I have is a probability distribution, a half for the 3 of clubs, a half for whatever it was, 4 of spades. Once you look at your card without telling me, then you now know what my card is. That's all that's going on here. Okay, when we get to Bell's theorem, we won't be able to use that model anymore, and that's what's amazing about it. Okay? But for this simple picture, it's sufficient. Okay, great. Well, if anyone has more questions, I'm available to chat over lunch.